Ian, you've spent a lot of time in the water over your life.
Well, I was sometimes trying to avoid getting actually in the water. That was a bad move when you capsize in a race. But yeah, on the water, in the water, my whole life, really.
What is it about the water keeps pulling you back?
Well, I think I first got into sailing, introduced to it. I was probably 6 years old. And I remember I was just thrown out on a little wooden boat on my own and, you know, slowly starting to get a handle for it and just, you know, real sense of freedom. I think when you're young, you're used to being told what to do by your mum and dad or by teachers, and suddenly you're on a little boat in the ocean. It all feels so big, so wide. And that's kind of, that feeling stayed with me. It's kind of changed and grown over the years. For me, the water is still about that sense of freedom, in that you same bit of water connects everywhere. And I love that. I always love the fact that you go out on our boat in Belfast Harbour, you actually, that same bit of water could connect every country of the world. And I'm, you know, that I'm a real believer in that, and how everyone's the same, everyone's equal. And the water for me represents that a little bit.
Mm. Yeah. Our local play park where we take our kids, they've got a wee diagram of the water cycle. Mm. And just, you know, there's the river there too. And my 3-year-old's like, so it's the same water that just goes round and round. I'm like, yeah, get your head around that one.
Exactly. Well, we get a lot of it coming from the sky.
Yeah, quite a lot of it. So you've had an amazing career as an Olympian, 3 medals. Unbelievable. We could spend 2 hours with you going into that. But what was the transition like for you going from racing boats to building them?
I had a kind of smooth transition. Well, I did 3 Olympics, and then I did a competition called the America's Cup, which is a sailing competition, a little bit like motorsport Formula One, is smaller scale, but still, you know, a real technology race. And so I was running a Swedish team in my last job there up to 2017. And by then, that's a team of about 150 people. It's very much an engineering challenge, management challenge. The sailing bit, although I was still involved, I realized was not the biggest driver of how well you did. So I, as the manager there and the team manager, I was already getting quite involved on those sides of it. And that always interests me. I think even in my Olympic sailing, what I enjoyed about the racing is the validation of the decisions and the teamwork. It's not so much the, you know, I'm not one to get on the podium and care about it, cheering at the end. It's about, you know, there's been a small team of you, know how much effort you've put in, and you feel a sense of pride in those decisions. And so for me, that's no different. As I move into running a business here in Belfast, it's exactly that same feeling I get with the team when we have good days, when we validate our decisions.
The outputs.
Exactly. The outputs for me is what proves that you've got the process right, but it's the process I enjoy. It's the working with other people. It's discovering things. My most fun days when I was Olympic racing is probably when we were testing a new idea, and in the tests, well away from the racing, you realized it was working, and that was binary, and you could feel that sense of pride in the team that had come up with it.
Yeah, and any technical experience alongside your athletic career?
But, well, before I got into sailing, I did economics and maths at university. So I not engineering, but mathematical modeling a lot with the economics. So I use quite a lot of that conceptually now that we're trying to always, and probably one of the concepts of racing and running the race team, and therefore indirectly the engineering team, is always trying to model in mathematically what you're trying to achieve. First, define what winning is. You know, it's simple at some level, get around a course quicker than someone else. But then when you've got game theory and you're competing with others, so define what winning is and then try and build models, mathematical models that express that. That's really what I've been doing for the whole part of my career, and harps back a little bit, yes, to my time at uni.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about what winning looks like for Artemis, the business, what does winning look like for you guys, and how are you going about that?
Well, we have two kind of primary things we're trying to achieve, and one leads to the other. You know, one is to have a successful, sustainable business, and the second is to decarbonize maritime. And one thing I learned, you know, it's obvious, but it's sometimes forgotten, you can make a technology that is decarbonizing, but if no one buys it because it's not economically viable,
right,
it doesn't decarbonize anything.
Yeah, it's nice theory, isn't it?
Yeah, and I went to a talk with Tesla when I was back in San Fran, and it was exactly the same point being made there. I mean, they claim a similar thing, that they're trying to decarbonize automotive, or they were when they started. Well, they still are, but you know what I mean? That was their motivation. But again, if no one buys your cars, you don't decarbonize anything. So I think for us, that's where that's what winning is. It's seeing a lot of our vessels on wind farms, oil and gas platforms, ferries around the world, and knowing that that represents both we made the correct decisions for our customers, but we also are decarbonizing in the same way.
Yeah, it's we talk to a lot of creatives and musicians and things like that on the show, and there's always that delicate dance between creation and profit, or passion and profit, I suppose you could say. And it's interesting how the same framework is at play here.
Yeah, it is. And you've got to be careful both ways, you know, because if you're too idealistic about things, you'll never achieve commercial success. And then you need commercial success to be able to change the dial and do anything. So if you don't have commercial success, but equally, if you throw away and just look for commercial success and forget what the original motivation was, you know, you can make a lot of money in other industries that are pretty polluting.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. If you're optimizing for money, there's probably better ways to do it and easier ways to do it, but it doesn't actually make an impact in the world that you're trying to make.
Yeah, and I guess one of the reasons I spend a fair bit of the time in policy or trying to talk with people around policy, because it's trying to be very transparent with policymakers to say, this is where we're at economically, this is where we're at environmentally. Economically is either less money or, and therefore we can benefit an industry, or we're about the same, or in some cases slightly more. Then say, well, you made the decision because at the moment you can nudge without having an environment, you can have an environmental positive impact without having a kind of hit on standard of living here, or you can, just trying to be as open as possible about that. We always try to be in a place where there was a genuine win-win. Mm. And because of that, sadly, in green technology, you get slightly niche, because one of the things I'm always at pains to point out is the energy transition is not full of win-wins. It has to have hits in the short term, hopefully only on standard of living. But I don't particularly believe, and I think in business we see this, that the movement of other businesses, because we're B2B, is driven by the finances, and therefore we need policy change as well. Fortunately, in a lot of our markets where a ferry does 200 miles a day, we save so much energy, we also can make it more cost effective. But that's not always the case. Sometimes us as society will have to pay.
Yeah. And so you guys created the world's first electric workboat, the world's first passenger ferry. Mm. How did you guys end up in those two markets?
Again, it's driven by the economics. Mm-hmm. It is fundamentally why we can be a viable kind of range with battery electric, is because coming out the water on these wings underwater, we reduce the drag significantly. But there's a lot of stuff there. There's a bit of cost involved in all that stuff to make that technology happen. And so the way that cost is justified is by the savings. And it's pretty linear. The more miles you do, the more savings you make. So the industries that work for us are the maritime industries that are where they're used a lot. So that, first of all, pretty much rules out recreational people, because most people see a boat, you know, have a boat. They go,
yeah, I'm not electrifying my canal boat anytime soon.
you go out once a weekend, one weekend a year, you know, you're never paying back that initial cost. Sure. But if you're a ferry going every day, 200 miles a day, or you're a pilot boat, or you're an offshore wind vessel, you're commercially being used every day. And so your savings justify the initial cost. In fact, over a very short period of time, you're ahead. Mm. And when you can show those sums up front and even take the risk out of it for customers, it's much, much easier to make the decision.
Yeah, no, I like that, being driven by the market while also trying to lead change on a more macro level as well. How'd you end up in Belfast?
It's a funny one. People often ask that. And the genuine reason, which is quite nice why it is, it's because of the people here. Mm. And not in a woolly way.
I'll give
you exactly why. Because we were looking for a place. So we needed a deep port. So it was kind of a fundamental that we needed, because we needed to be putting our vessels into the water. So we needed to be by the coast. And literally the reason we're here is, when I came here, I met with Joe Neal from Belfast Harbour, met with the university, and, you know, being frank, they met with me and they were very welcoming. They introduced us to more people. They said that they would be part of a consortium and get behind it. And it grew. Other places around the UK didn't grasp it in that way. They're very polite, of course, but it was, yeah, we'll get back to you. And I think I often wonder why that was. And I think there's a couple of things. I think one, there has been industry leading from Belfast over the centuries, from Northern Ireland. And so they don't think of it as a pipe dream in the way maybe other parts of the UK do, you know. And Yeah, you could say finance in London is strong, but you know, not many places have lead industries,
right?
Like they have here, shipbuilding, like, or linen, boats. Or this machining, and particularly boats. And so it's not a get out of here, you dreamer, to such an extent. And then I think if I'm being an outsider looking in, there's been that starving of opportunity because of years of division that people are keen to embrace behind. They are so much. The irony of the level of collaboration I see between businesses and individuals here is really, really strong. And I think there's that kind of, we just want to get on with the having success and enjoying working together. And so that's the genuine reason. It was that the people here that I spoke to about this project took it seriously, didn't tell me to get out of the room, and got behind it. And you know, collectively, the Belfast Maritime Consortium that we became have made a success of it. So, you know, they were right.
Yeah. There's a hunger to Belfast that I really appreciate. And I left when I was 18. I was in the States for 3 years. When I came back, I loved that energy. Like, there was a desire. And you could say it's a post-Good Friday Agreement where there's kind of all this pent-up entrepreneurial energy just like starting to punch through. But I wanted to be a part of it. And that's why I love working here and why I love being based in the city as well, because you get to tap into that.
No, I very much felt the same. And I think it is. It's a hunger is the right way to describe it. A hunger and a willingness and an openness to things, you know, that comes from, as I say, maybe that history of success and that starvation of opportunity that there was for a period means it's let's go for it. And that's what you feel. And you get that, we get that from our team too.
Yeah.
That desire to go for it.
Yeah. What's been the pros and cons of bringing an Olympian mindset to business?
probably asking the wrong words. You should ask the people who I work with. But look, in all the race teams I was involved in, there was a clarity around timing, particularly. Because races started when the races start, and I got used to very much changing the output to do the best you can in the time you have. And in business, I would say it's more a case of following a process to do what you set out to do. And so for me, I bring a kind of inherent desire to do things when you have to slip time, scope, or money to slip money and scope and keep to time, because that's what I've always done. And that isn't necessarily how normal business runs or necessarily should run. And so there's that clashing at times of that, but you know, that's inherent in me from my racing. And I think, I hope that is positive, but you know, obviously when you push really hard on things and you've got to understand the need for work-life balance and in areas of sport, that probably isn't there as much. People are, they've kind of given up on the work-life balance in sport, and I long since had to give up on the work-life balance. So, but look, I think I'm lucky. I think it works. I think the fact that we do have a core from the old racing world that's there that is a positive, and I think it runs through. I think the world, the other thing that we bring from racing that's a positive is that idea of really being a team and the friendship. Inside and outside work, the informal communication, the desire to have a mission. And I think that's something that's, I hope that people enjoy within Artemis.
Yeah. I was talking to a programmer the other day, and there's a kind of new programming workflow called Shape Up. And the idea is that you have fixed time, but the scope is variable.
Yeah.
That's the first time I was introduced to that idea.
Yeah.
And I understand where in your industry and where you're at, that there's tension there. I personally like fixed time. Here's the deadline. We're going to ship a podcast. We're going to ship a new process. We're going to ship a new product at this time, kind of no matter what. And we'll figure out what that looks like in terms of quality levels, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I know. I agree. And I've seen so much achieved in the last period of racing cycles when there's an element that everyone's showing their hands. You learn fast through that. But it's, I think my feeling would be the same as you, that you tend to not have to slip the scope as much as you like, as you think. If you, and actually sometimes being forced to make decisions is the best thing to do.
Yeah, action. You learn a lot through action. Has that tension increased the bigger the business has got? Because I imagine in the early stages, that propensity to action is extremely useful.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, as you get, they always talk about businesses as they get above 120, 150 people get much harder to run in the same informal ways, in the same.
And you guys are at the 150 mark?
We're about, more 180, 190. And wow. I think, so processes do need to come in. Processes are so much more set around fixed scope, fixed work packages, fixed period of time, and they're much harder to move a larger organization or larger projects to change scope because that's a lot of communication, whereas sticking to scope and the time being more of an output is much, much easier to manage in a bigger setup. And I think as you get larger, you can make planning and organizations more process and program driven. When you need to make quick decisions, you need to have projects run much more by kind of complete domain experts. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't work as you grow. So I think we are inevitably in a bit of a process of change, and I'm probably the Luddite holding it back, still wanting to just snap decisions and get stuff done.
What's it been like for you personally as a leader to start to let go of things as, you know, everything gets bigger?
I think I missed bits of it for sure. I was much more involved technically in the race teams than I am now. Ultimately, a race team is the same as producing a commercial product without the need to sell it or finance the business. So now I've got to worry about selling it and financing the business. That ends up taking a lot of my time. And so I miss being as involved on the technical. I enjoy that, exactly what we've just been talking about, the need to make a decision in the whole, in the round, considering time scope, cost, but also customer, product, what are you trying to achieve, and making those trade-off decisions. I used to enjoy doing that in the racing world, and I'm not as involved. We're lucky to have great people in our team that do that, I'm sure, a lot better than I could. But so I miss it personally. I think you know, it's an inevitability about it. I have a responsibility to make sure the business is funded and we can keep doing the things that we say we're setting out to do. So that's got to be priority number one. So I end up focusing my time there, maybe more than I used to.
Sure. So you do have the racing side to the business. Like, how important is that performance element, and how does that kind of shape the rest of the business, if that makes sense?
Yeah, we started out as a consulting business in 2017. I mean, we were essentially the race design team and myself. And so we were doing design projects for other race teams, sometimes running race teams as a whole for sponsors and owners. And that bit still exists. That's called Artemis Applied Technologies. And that was actually where we started. We were always looking to decarbonize and find a product that could hit this kind of economically and environmentally sustainable. So that continues, that business grows and is going well, and people are going to see some cool boats coming here over the next few months as well, sailing around on the lock. But I think it works really well because on a technical level, it works really well because working with race sailors in this case often, they're very, very sensitive to the accuracy of our physics modeling. And so they're very picky. I mean, if it doesn't feel right, they're into you about it. And that feeds back directly into our modeling of autonomous ferries. Because one of the amazing things about autonomous kind of oxymoron autonomous things is you don't get feedback you get feedback through data, but you don't get feedback in such a kind of instant human that doesn't feel right way. So you can end up going down with assumptions that are wrong. So that's a real positive feedback. I think the other aspect is it's enjoyed by the team. I think us being involved in racing, it's fun to be part of, you know, events are fun to watch, knowing that you've been part of that success and watching it on the TV. So I think that's also, so I think it's kind of staff engagement and just this feedback of,
right,
of physics model validation.
Yeah, so it's almost like you get a lot of innovation learnings from the racing side that you can then roll out across the your entire portfolio, for lack of a better term.
Some of its ideas, I would say mainly it's validation of physics-based simulation models. So it's validation of how, say, foils are treating waves and how the motion of boats is in waves. It's more at a fundamental level of validation. There's an element of ideas, but it's more validation, I would say. It's the strongest link between our racing world and our commercial vessel design.
Yeah. I was on a call the other day with a guy in, where was he? He's a VC guy in Singapore, and he was talking about Artemis, and I was like, okay. Artemis is definitely spreading out across this little planet of ours. What are you guys doing around the world?
I didn't know about the VC guy. Very, very. I think we will all end up being 95% an export business. So our customers are worldwide. So our activity is worldwide.
So Vess and I just love you right now.
I guess it. No, we have a good relationship with them. But I think things like, yeah, so as I said, our customers are driven by their use case more than anything else. If you have a vessel that is used every single day and needs to go fast, it's another critical element to our technology. So generally people being transported, then we're probably the only people in the world that tick that box. And so we offer this thing that's cheaper and environmentally friendly. So to the right, it is niche, but to that niche, we're kind of gold dust. So going around to where that activity is, and fast ferries are pretty evenly spread between Europe, US and Australasia. And wind is quite focused, North Sea actually at the moment, but growing rapidly around the world. Pilot boats is everywhere, ports all around the world, depends a lot. So the criteria for our approach to customers worldwide is really their transfer time. If you're in a really port that you drop off your pilots on their ships 1 mile away, that's not the customers for us, but the ones like Belfast Harbour that are 15 odd miles away, we'll be saving them $250,000 in fuel every year when they're using our pilot boat here.
They'll be happy about that. So you guys have fallen into, don't mean that flippantly, you've arrived at a very, very, very hyper-specific niche that in a local market, business would tank, but you've been able to take that hyper-niche, reach a global market, and now you've got an incredible business. I like that idea. I love niches. Yeah. I love the fact that you can take it anywhere.
It's a niche where it's a very strong value proposition with a lot of barriers to entrance, be it complexity, IP, investment. And so, and it's in a market where people appreciate it. They want these solutions, but it's physically very, very hard to do. So not many people do it. So if you're talking to an oil and gas transfer, you know, they're really keen for lots of reasons to decarbonize their activities because they're pulling carbon out of the ground. So if you can offer them opportunities to transfer their crew out to rigs and islands in a zero emissions manner, you know, you're really giving them something that's priceless to them.
Mm.
Well, I would say priceless. They don't seem to think quite priceless.
There is a price.
There seems there to unfortunately be a price.
Wrapping up, Ian, if you kind of think about your big picture vision here, what does that look like and what's the next few steps to get there?
Well, we need a way to scale globally. I think that's the interesting stuff for us and the process we're going through now. That Belfast is our hub. It's always going to be our hub. We're always going to keep the key complex manufacturing and engineering here in Belfast. We're determined to do that. We built a team. We're anchored by our talent as well and by our team. But to deliver around the world, we need to have boat building hubs where our customers are. So we build motors and batteries and hydrofoils and systems effectively here. And around the world, we need to have a supplier of boats in the US and Asia. So building that scale out to have a global footprint on the boat bit whilst maintaining this and keeping the IP tight here in Belfast is the next 3 years for us. And that's a huge challenge. I mean, opening up factories around the world and also growing here probably 3 or 4 times to then feed the boat building facilities worldwide. That's it. You know, funny with businesses as they grow, they it's a sales challenge and real quickly it flips and it's an operational challenge.
Interesting. So, I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the hospitality at Belfast has been, I'll say, helpful in your journey. There's lots of people that listen to the show in lots of different niches and industries and parts of the world. Some people listen to the show because it's like Tato crisps for their ears. It's how they stay connected to home. How can we help? So if you're talking to, you know, anyone listening, what do you need and how can we help you?
We have been really helped, I would say. I think, you know, for us, I think the skills that we have here are 80% met by the people, which is fantastic. And then there's always 20% that doesn't happen to be served because there isn't a much of a history. And I think the really powerful message things like this does is telling the world what I know, which is not only is a great place to work, it's a great place to live, you know, and it's not known that. And so for us, attracting the 20% of people who aren't naturally fed by the universities or colleges here, which is ironically actually about some things a bit more like naval architecture, where although it was a massive industry has dropped off, and whereas when you talk about mechanical engineers, it's nowhere like, you know, the students that are coming out of the university here, just fantastic skill set. So I think just for us, spreading the word about, as we all do, about what a great place this is to work and live really helps industries like us. And then I guess as consumers here, you know, we're really keen to launch this demonstration service here. I mean, one of the main things is we want the first place that has a zero emissions high speed foiling ferry to be here in Belfast, where it came from. And I think there is some natural routes for it here, and just, you know, getting on your bike and getting on the ferry and realizing that there's another way, you know, having a beer while you wait to jump on the ferry back at the end of the day. So embrace that. It's a world of, way of life that I've seen in San Fran and other parts of the world that can really add to people's day. So jump on that ferry when it runs.
Love it, man. Favorite place to get in the water in Northern Ireland, real quick.
Yeah, get out. Well, get on the water in general too here. It's a cool place to be sailing.
Where's your favorite place in Northern Ireland to get in the water?
Strangford Lock, probably. Yeah. I live down there. And like just, it's unbelievable. It's like Swallows and Amazons, all the little islands and pubs. I mean, if that was anywhere else, you wouldn't get a 20 deep at the bar, but you can go and sit in these cool little spots and just enjoy its surroundings. It's you're very, very lucky here.
Ian, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Cheers.